Okay, I think it's about time to close out the week. It's Friday, this is The Damage Report. I'm Johnny Roll, and Brett Ehrlich is here.
I'm here.
Representing S.H.I.E.L.D., I think.
And like douchey t-shirt jacket scenarios. Mm-hmm. That's also what I'm representing, but
I think it's kind of messed up that you steal Ben Mankiewicz's style without him being here to defend his honor.
I'm texting him right now, actually. Okay. I'm wearing a Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. S.H.I.E.L.D. badge. Today is not only International Women's Day, great work, but also Captain Marvel comes out today. And mm-hmm. I was like kind of not excited about it yesterday. I don't know what came over me. I'm excited about it today.
You're a misogynist, that's why.
She's the hero we need right now, according to many articles.
And thanks to Thanos, she's one of the few that we still have. So we're going to see what she can do. And I'm going to be going to see it tonight. I can't wait.
Spoiler alert.
It's been long enough. Anyway, it's also been long enough into the show that we haven't even talked about the news yet. So here's what's going to be talking about over the course of the show. In just a little bit, Paul Manafort has been sentenced. Sort of. We're going to break that down. A little bit later on, Joe Biden is a guy who has a lot of video waiting to come out about him from the 80s and 90s and 2000s. We've got some and some quotes. It doesn't look great. And so we're going to be talking about that. Also, should you boycott cookies because of AOC? We'll debate that in the serious fashion that it deserves. We're going to be closing out the show even more serious. There was a gigantic domestic incident last weekend where I shaved my facial hair and it set the internet on fire. And so we're going to be reading comments of people making fun of me for that
decision. It also set the concept of decency on fire.
Exactly.
And what one should look like on television.
Exactly. And we have not recovered yet, although I am working at it follicularly. Along the way, we've got two great guests. So in just a little bit, Parker Malloy of Media Matters is going to be joining us to talk about Tucker Carlson and the ways that he sort of uses populist sentiments to lead people to crazy conclusions. She's done a great analysis of that. She'll be breaking that down. And Jordan Yule is going to be joining us to break down some of the news of the day, including the big anti-hate resolution that passed Congress yesterday. And we're going to talk about who voted for it, but also who voted against it in just a little bit later on the show. But first, Paul Manafort. Paul Manafort, former campaign chairman of Donald Trump's presidential campaign, was sentenced to nearly 4 years in prison. That might sound like a lot, but he was facing far more. And so that was actually far lighter than the 19 to 24 year prison term recommended under sentencing guidelines. I've done the math, and it's like 15 years or more less than that. Judge T.S. Ellis, who I think is a novelist, of the United States District Court in Alexandria, Virginia, said that although his crimes were, quote, very serious, following the guidelines would have resulted in an unduly harsh punishment. Well, then I think you need to change the sentencing guidelines if it's unduly harsh and it is what is stipulated.
Seems like
you could have gone for longer.
There are all kinds of unduly harsh punishment guidelines in America.
Yes.
And this is not one of them. Mm-hmm. I would say basically not registering as a foreign agent. Mm-hmm. And then all these things that are reserved typically for folks who are cheating us out of tax money, mm-hmm. the white collar cheating, that stuff, it's not an unduly harsh punishment. And there's one thing to say it's an unduly harsh punishment to have 24 years and then actually sentence him to 15. Mm-hmm. That is still over a decade, but it is another thing to go from 2-4 and then just shorten it to 4. Mm-hmm. That is a lot.
Yeah.
That is way shorter than it should be.
Yeah, look, I want to do some more comparison to the treatment he was given, the treatment other people have. Thankfully, people have been doing that, and I think it's important because people need to understand the injustice just baked into our justice system in terms of how sentencing plays out in general. But while he has nearly 4 years in prison, he is going to be going in front of Judge Amy Berman Jackson for two conspiracy counts. That is just in next week, actually. And for those charges, he faces up to 5 additional years, which will probably be knocked down to a fortnight.
Whereas this judge here in this case, T.S. Mm-hmm. Eliot, when T.S. Eliot, the judge,
T.S. Ellis,
this hollow man.
Yes.
Went from sentencing him to a bang to a whimper.
something, Tolkien. I don't know.
I had something
anyway,
for this.
He could go for longer in the end. That is true.
This judge did everything during the process of the prosecution's case to undercut the prosecution. Whatever the prosecution was talking about, this extravagant lifestyle that Manafort was leading, the judge was like, all right, that's enough with the ostrich coats. And even there was a moment written about, I think in Washington Post or LA Times, where they said, During the prosecution's case, the judge asked the prosecutor to watch his facial expressions. Mm-hmm. That kind of stuff. That happened along the way. Judge Amy Berman Jackson, she is the one whom it had been posted about the the crosshairs and all
from
that stuff.
From Roger Stone.
So yeah. she does not have a favorable experience with this, with whole the prosecutions thing that have emerged from the Mueller investigation.
That's
so we'll
true.
See if she would intervene to go lighter, especially if she's doing things like giving Roger Stone extended gag orders.
Exactly, yeah. Now, as we said, thankfully, look, social media generally, I think we can all agree, has been just a horrible thing. Like, just wait until people start saying what they think about Captain Marvel later on tonight. That'll be great. They go in with totally open minds.
John will put a gag order in on
but anyway,
criticizing Marvel movies.
There are some good things. No, you can criticize it, but I'm sure some have already posted critical things. They had to shut down the ratings, or the comments on, I think it was on Rotten Tomatoes, because people were voting it down, having not seen it.
Oh,
I wonder why. Maybe they just don't like superheroes.
They work for DC.
Kind of doubt it. That could be
Hydra.
But anyway, there are good things about social media, including people pointing out injustice when it rears its ugly head. So Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said, Paul Manafort getting such little jail time for such serious crimes lays out for the world how it's almost impossible for rich people to go to jail for the same amount of time as someone who is lower income. In our current broken system, justice isn't blind, it's bought. That should be on at least a bumper sticker, if not a hat, if you can fit it. Elizabeth Warren said Trump's campaign manager Paul Manafort commits bank and tax fraud and gets 47 months. A homeless man, Fate Winslow, helped sell $20 of pot and got life in prison. Laura Coates pointed out that in 2018, Judge Ellis sentenced Frederick Turner, 37, to a mandatory minimum of 40 years in prison for dealing meth. Quote, if I chafe a bit at that, but I follow the law. If I thought it was blatantly immoral, I'd have to resign. It's wrong, but not immoral. So that's a different standard to some extent, but it was a long time ago. It was last year. Also, public defender Scott Hetchinder pointed out that, quote, for context on Manafort's 47 months in prison, my client yesterday was offered 36 to 72 months in prison for stealing $100 worth of quarters from a residential laundry room. I don't know why that wasn't fixed in post. Then, Crystal Mason, you might remember, is a black woman who accidentally committed voter fraud back in the 2016 election, having voted when she wasn't eligible, but believed that she was. She was given 5 years. Now, here's the thing, that was an accident. It wasn't even stealing quarters. Paul Manafort, he knowingly committed fraud for years and years, possibly decades, but we know for years and years, knowingly, even though he was very well connected, very rich, could have lived the rest of his life in luxury without ever falling afoul of the law or ethics or anything like that even once, he chose to do that, defrauding the US government, international governments, every sense of common decency, all of that. And he's gonna be out, when he gets out after this term, he's gonna be younger than Bernie is now. So we have a weird system that we've set up here, unfortunately. But we'll see
CNN
what happens to him next
makes,
week.
CNN will say that makes him a more viable presidential candidate.
Perhaps, we'll see if he runs next time around. Anyway, we are gonna take a break though. When we come back, Tucker Carlson, he's on a mission. But what is he actually trying to achieve? Parker Malloy has done some research and she's gonna break it down for us after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called The Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of The Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, you must unlearn what you have learned. And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Joining us now to break down some of her amazing recent reporting on Tucker Carlson and what he is getting up to on Fox News every night is the editor at large for Media Matters for America, Parker Malloy. Parker, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Very glad to have you here, and in particular to talk about this because I very much enjoyed your article. Everyone watching this should go to Media Matters and take a look at it. But you basically wrote that he is a master at the art of misdirection. Could you explain your thesis for our audience?
Sure. So one of the things that I've kind of noticed is so Tucker Carlson on his show, a lot of times he will talk about the ruling class. He likes to blame things on the ruling class, which is fair. You know, we do have a ruling class, as all societies do, but he never elaborates on what he really means by that. So a few weeks ago, I started reading his book, which talks about how the ruling class is destroying America, basically. And he doesn't get into it there so much either. So I started watching clip after clip after clip of his show, especially the ones where he will say something that progressives will kind of nod our heads to, thinking, yes, this makes sense. And you see sometimes he'll get he'll get praised, like what was it, Vox wrote something. Vox had a story that said, last Wednesday, the conservative talk show host started a fire on the right after airing a prolonged monologue on a show that was, in essence, an indictment of American capitalism. Now, that sounds progressive. That sounds kind of awesome. And if you listen to what he's saying, it sometimes can sound that way, the way he'll talk about taxes or the way he'll talk about Amazon, for instance. But One thing I always find when I watch these segments is they'll start out talking about something like that, a real problem in the world, like why is the tax code so complex, or why do tech companies like Facebook continue to pump out products that they know are potentially harmful and are addictive by design. And so he'll make these good points, but then he'll come to some sort of really bonkers conclusion. He'll talk about how the suicide rate for men is too high, and then he'll end with the conclusion that women should not be in the workplace or something like that, where it's just like so disconnected and you're like, how did I get here? And so that's what this article tries to do. It tries to break down how he gets there. And essentially, I kind of liken it to rhetorical sleight of hand. So basically what he does is he'll say something that will get people on board, and then he'll just sort of pivot. And he uses this concept of the ruling class as his pivot point, where he'll argue that this ruling class is trying to appease identity-based groups. So what he likes to do is he likes to then basically pivot and blame problems like stagnant wages on gay people, or unemployment, only partial employment. He'll blame that on companies that are trying to appease trans people or people of color, or that care about diversity. You know, he refers to this as a diversity cult. But at the same time, he contradicts himself constantly. You know, in his book, he talks about how, you know, if you wanted to run a country for the benefit of everyone, you would de-emphasize differences between us. And he'll point to the left to say that we tend to emphasize those differences, and that's what's dividing us. But then later in the book, he'll make the same argument, saying that people trying to argue that men are the same as women, or that have the same capabilities and interests and stuff like that, that those people just aren't living in reality. So he'll say these two things that are at their face contradictory, but it's all in the service of getting to his kind of fringy conclusions, which if he starts off that way, people like you and me, we won't tune into it. We're not likely to tune into something if he just starts off and says, so how about white supremacy, and just like dives in like with a pro white supremacy message. So he has to kind of lure us in with these little bits, these little criticizing Amazon, or talking about how the tax system's too complicated, or that, we don't care about the poor, these things like that, workers' conditions. He talks about workers' conditions in his book, which is kind of amazing because that doesn't match up with his actual politics. But he talks about these things as actual problems, and they are. He just always comes to these conclusions that are far-fetched, to say, you know, at best.
Yeah, and that the policy implications are the same as any Republican politician would come up with. And in the end, the groups that he blames are the same that Sean Hannity would, or that the Five would in those same situations. He just helps to muddle what a ruling class in theory would actually be. I love that, like, who is the ruling class? Ooh, gay interests, obviously, clearly. He says journalists too. He'll attack Amazon because he doesn't like the particular politics that he thinks the person who owns it has. Here's something. I mean, he talks about journalists. You sort of get into this in your piece. In what possible world is, with the vague definitions that he has applied to this ruling class, is he not a part of it?
Right. That I kind of, especially because one of the things he says in his book is he talks about how Mark Zuckerberg cannot be, he's detached from the world, and he can't understand what it's like because he's always grown up in this sort of bubble. And how has Tucker Carlson not? Tucker Carlson was born into a well-off family that then became an extremely wealthy family. So his experience is just as shielded as Mark Zuckerberg's. You know, he takes jabs at Zuckerberg. I think the way he frames it is in some like vaguely anti-Semitic kind of way. That's where he talks about orthodontists, the children of orthodontists, and stuff like that. Which is just, I don't know. There are all these like tiny dog whistles in his in both his book and on his show, obviously. So he does that, and he uses that as a disqualifier for, you know, clearly Zuckerberg doesn't know what's going on because of how he was raised, because he was shielded from real life implications and real life struggles. But Tucker Carlson is the exact same way. He is just as shielded. He grew up and didn't really ever have didn't really struggle. He was born into a family that had some great ties in media. You know, his stepmother is the heiress to the Swanson frozen food empire, I guess. So there's money, there's connections. He's got it all. And I think what kind of scared me about all of this, not scared me so much as just kind of intrigued me, because as you sort of said, he's not like Sean Hannity. He is not like, he's not like the Five, but he comes to the same conclusions.
Yeah.
And I think the difference there is that Tucker Carlson's very smart, and that's what makes him very effective. You know, I kind of see Hannity as this sort of oafish character, whereas Carlson, you know, if he wanted to, I think he could be an extremely successful politician in terms of getting people on board, because what he says, everything comes off as this sort of Rorschach kind of test where you'll hear what you want to hear, which is the same exact thing that you saw with Donald Trump when he was running. You know, you saw people who they were against immigration, and they saw his policies as being against immigration. Mm-hmm. And whereas, you know, then you see people who are more liberal or progressive, they'll see things like, well, he held up a gay pride flag once, so clearly he cares about this group. And so it's this thing where you throw out so much information that people can cherry pick what they want to justify siding with you. And I think that's one thing that Tucker Carlson does really, really well. And, you know, if he wasn't raking in so much money on TV and didn't have this, you know, decades long history of being on TV, you know, if he just kind of popped up out of nowhere and had these politics and had this rhetorical style, I think that he could be an extremely successful politician. I don't think that would be a good thing personally. But at the same time, you know, it's very fascinating. You know, there are some people I think that you can kind of take shots at their intelligence, but when it comes to Tucker Carlson, I think he's an extremely smart man.
I don't necessarily agree, but I haven't read as much of his book as you have, so I will defer to you in that area. our audience should definitely look up your write-up on this on Media Matters. Parker, again, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We're gonna take a short break. We come back, lots more to get to. Okay, so one of the things that's going to be tough for some of those who are running in the Democratic primary is their long histories. I mean, we saw that the last time around, that both Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton have been around for a long time. So you can not only take issue or be a fan of things that they said 2 years ago, but possibly 10 or 20 or even longer. With Bernie, you can go back 40 years. Joe Biden is another one of those politicians because he has been around for longer than a good chunk of the people who will be voting this primary have been alive. And some of the things he's said in the past are not gonna play well. And so here is an example. This surfaced recently. This came in a 1975 interview with a local newspaper. And so he was talking about the concept of reparations in the area of busing, of sending white children to predominantly black schools and black children to predominantly white schools as a way to affirmatively integrate those schools. Here are some of the things he said. I do not buy the concept popular in the 1960s, which said, quote, "We have surpassed the black man for 300 years and the white man is now far ahead in the race for everything our society offers. In order to even the score, we must now give the black man a head start or even hold the white man back to even the race." I don't buy that. He goes on to say, "We've lost our bearings since the 1954 Brown versus School," I think he means the Board of Education, desegregation case. To desegregate is different than to integrate. I'm philosophically opposed to quota systems. They ensure mediocrity. And one more quote, this is kind of a big one, but buckle up. "The new integration plans being offered are really just quota systems to assure a certain number of blacks, Chicanos, or whatever in each school. That, to me, is the most racist concept you can come up with. What it says is, in order for your child with curly black hair, brown eyes, and dark skin to be able to learn anything, he needs to sit next to my blonde-haired, blue-eyed son. That's racist. Who the hell do we think we are that the only way a black man or woman can learn is if they rub shoulders with my white child?"
So
I would reword that in some fundamental ways.
You know someone's been around politics and the world for a long time if they say things like the black man and the white man.
Yeah. It reeks of 1975.
It's
and
interesting.
Earlier.
This happens a lot. The way, and I'm not going to defend Joe Biden's statements in any respect, but I will add something. There is something to the way that Joe Biden talks where you are able to write it off as crazy Uncle Joe sometimes, mm-hmm. which made him the perfect vice president. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at it, it's not just things like this. It's also like the frequent statements like, "Oh, where is that guy who was paralyzed? He's in the audience. There he is. Could you stand up for me? Could you stand up? He's a great guy."
Yeah.
Those awkward things. He also said, No Filter this week had a bunch of clips of old things that he had said.
And
Of Joe Biden. And the previous week was things that Bernie had said.
Yes.
And Bernie's that he could have said them yesterday. It was the same stuff.
It does sound exactly
Biden,
same.
It's just he has less frequently been Joe Biden, comma, liability.
Yeah.
He said another things like, you know, there's a lot of, in Delaware, Indian Americans are the number one growing population. And you cannot go into a 7-Eleven or a Dunkin' Donuts unless you have a slight Indian accent. Am I right? And the way you were reading it took away that extra part, which does make mm-hmm. you feel crazy when you're listening to it, but in a completely different way.
It's a newspaper interview. So
I would say that Joe Biden is different from Hillary Clinton in that when he talks, you see a person. It could be a crazy person,
yeah.
but at least you're getting like there's a personality there. But yeah, these are not good things to have said.
No. Some people will say, hey, it was 1975.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people will respond with, yeah. Okay, it's still, geez.
We just went through an election, a presidential election, where the guy said which part of a woman he would grab them by. We heard it, he won.
Yeah.
So I would say, yes, your job definitely is to point these things out. Mm-hmm. And it should be incumbent on the American population to say, oh, that does seem terrible. Mm-hmm. I really need to weigh this in my decision. But what we can run into is the possibility that along the way, people could hear Joe Biden and just be like, I would just want to go back to something Obama-like.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, the difference is that Donald Trump rose to the top of a Republican primary talking like that. Joe Biden wants to apparently rise to the top of a Democratic primary, which is a slightly different thing. And I mean, I don't know. These are not just comments. These are comments with policy implications, sure, of a different era. And it's possible that since 1975 and since things that he did also along the way in the 90s and stuff like that, that he has evolved. But he's going to have to show that he's evolved, which is something that some of the other candidates don't have to do.
He beat Obama to the punch on gay marriage.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. The thing is, and honestly, look, maybe once he starts talking, people are going to, as you say, hear, you know, crazy Uncle Joe. The thing is,
Avuncular.
It's not like he hasn't run multiple times. He didn't like win over huge crowds then.
But everyone runs the last election. Mm-hmm. You know, people didn't like the thing that Hillary represented.
Yeah.
And what they don't like now is what Trump represents. And they might just want something back. And there's a lot of practical things that you have to think about where they're running primaries. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of primaries that are front loaded. Yeah. And in the beginning, Bernie has a lane, Biden has a lane, everyone else is fighting.
Yeah.
So they could just rack up electoral votes.
I can see some of these other candidates busting into Biden's lane and taking it over and representing that appeal. Okay. All I'm saying is this was a 1975 interview with a local newspaper. There are going to be a lot of people reading old newspapers and watching old C-SPAN. And they're going to see a lot of things that are going to be really hard to explain in a Democratic primary that is going to have a bigger focus on trying to appeal to progressive voters than any primary ever has. Anyway, let's have a little bit of fun.
Nope.
We will.
Nope, sorry.
I'm gonna.
Can't.
I would like to.
All right.
Can I?
Yeah.
It's Friday.
Makes sense.
Thank you. Let's talk about cookies. Today is International Women's Day. And some people, happy about that, think it's important that we focus on the contributions of women and uplifting them. Others feel like, nope, there's women that are pissing us off, so we're gonna take down an organization aimed at girls, actually, as a result of that. So I want to talk about Jane Chastain, who is a pretty awful right-wing writer. She took issue with a particular group, that is the Girl Scouts. So she said in an article, "The Girl Scouts were an important part of my formative years, and I sold hundreds of boxes of these cookies myself. So I considered it payback, paying it forward, so to speak, in buying them. Not anymore. Today's Girl Scouts are a far cry from those of my youth, which trained us to put God and country before anything else. Today, God in the Girl Scout premise has an asterisk, meaning the great I am and his moral absolutes can be replaced by anything, including oneself." Now that is just general, I don't like the Girl Scouts anymore.
What
they're too secular.
If you're gonna say the great I am, you need to go the great he who is I am. I went to Catholic school.
Oh, there you go. But this is not just about the Girl Scouts. This is about a particular female politician on International Women's Day. The Girl Scouts are celebrating the victory won by their alums in the 2018 midterms on its website, beginning with their star, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who attributes much of her success to what she learned as part of this organization. "Before you decide to embrace an International Women's Day celebration or buy the cookies, ask yourself, quote, will the country be better off with more representatives like the young socialist Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez? If not, it's a good time to start your diet." It is a good time, but not for that reason. I'm gonna rank that low. Now, AOC believes that one should respond to these crazy things, and she's explained why we showed on the show. She said, "Boycotting cookies that teach little girls leadership skills to own the libs. Nice job. I'll take 10. I too will take 10 later on today when I go to Ralph's."
Oh my God.
This is a serious article. Oh, by the way, can I give AOC credit? So she also she plugged her constituents' work in setting up Troop 6000. It's the first ever Girl Scouts troop for girls experiencing homelessness. How awesome is that?
Evil.
Where's God? Not on the streets.
Thin mints. First of all, they're amazing, and I love everything of it. And I think that AOC should go like organization by organization and food by food and endorse it wholeheartedly and say it made her who she was, so that this woman has nothing to eat or drink or do.
I'm so mad and so hungry.
Oh no, air. She attributes much of her life force to breathing air.
Well, we already know her AOC's positions on cars and hamburgers.
And
she likes them as a hypocrite would.
She should use all the quotes like AOC, really, the great I am is the one who motivated me to get into politics. So she has to choose between God and not God.
Mm. Anyway, don't set yourself up as being opposed to Girl Scout cookies. Is there anything that people like more wholeheartedly look at those.
Boy Scout popcorn, obviously.
Oh my God,
I want that so bad.
Oh my God, those look great. Thin Mints. Look, we're not sponsored by them, obviously. I don't think they sponsor things, but I like cookies. I just want to make that very clear. Okay, we're going to take a break. We come back, Jordan Yule is going to be joining us. We'll be breaking down some of the news of the day, including yesterday's anti-hate resolution, which some people absolutely hated, and more after this. Joining us once again on the show to break down some of the big news of the morning, Jordan Yule, welcome back to the show.
John, thank you for having me.
Good to have you here. There's a lot I want to get to, but I want to start off with one of the, I guess, the big congressional actions of the week. Yesterday, we finally had the vote on the big anti-hate resolution, which was initially created as an anti-Semitism measure because of the comments of Representative Ilhan Omar. It was broadened to be against all forms of hate, which was controversial somehow. And so it has passed. And so before we get to those who voted against it, in terms of the entire saga from the beginning to now, if you had been in congressional leadership, how would you have handled this whole situation?
A lot differently than it was handled. I think the one thing that should be said is, like you pointed out, this came as a result of Ilhan Omar's criticisms of AIPAC and the influence it has over Congress. So for people to take that and run with it as some sort of anti-Semitic attack, to me, illustrates an inability to have meaningful, serious conversations about the role and influence lobbying groups have in Congress. It's a bit alarming that we break down on sort of these like optics. I wonder how different the conversation might have been if, say, Peter King in New York made the same criticism that ever. What really frustrates me about the way that whole situation went down is they dragged their feet when Steve King literally asked the question when white supremacy became offensive. They did nothing with Steve King's white nationalist comments, including we can't rebuild our society with someone else's babies, his repeated attacks on people of color and immigrants. But now suddenly we're prompted with this immediate need to address very specific forms of speech. And mind you, Steve King voted present on that bill.
Yeah. Well, actually, why don't we turn to that? Because although there's little I hate more than both sidesing things, in the end, the bill did denounce all forms of anti-Semitism, but also dealing with Islamophobia and other sorts of isms as well. And as you point out, there's this long history of ignoring certain acts. I mean, even Jim Jordan, like a lot of people online, like we were tweeting about it, but nobody seems to really care that he implied that, again, that the money behind a Jewish billionaire was controlling the Democratic Party. AOC had tweeted, where's the outrage over the 23 GOP members who voted no on that resolution? Oh, there's none. Did they get called out, raked over, ambushed in halls, and relentlessly asked why not? No? Okay, got it. So we're going to talk about it at the very least. So 23 voted no. Many have not provided any explanation for that yet, but we do know that Steve King voted present, which I just love. Louis Gohmert said that it was too broad, and Liz Cheney said it's a sham designed to protect Ilhan Omar. I always think the best way to protect a representative is to do a congressional denunciation of their action, but what do you think about this, that denouncing all forms of hatred is too broad to support?
I don't understand the argument. Honestly, I've thought about it a lot. It does not make sense. But one thing I did want to point out that Paul Gosar, member of Congress also who voted no, his family members, his own family members, immediate family, brothers and sisters, ran against him because he was so racist. So when you look at this public posturing from people like Gohmert and Liz Cheney, like you can make your own assumptions, but I do want people to understand that someone who voted the same way as them literally had his own siblings running attack ads against him because he was so racist.
Wow. Okay, well, I want to turn now to another development. Recently, there was this story going around that a conservative group had accused Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and her staff of committing some sort of campaign finance violation, which apparently campaign finance experts are saying is not actually against the law what they did. And in fact, the group had been openly talking about the way that they were using money since 2016 at the very least. Now, she says that the reason this is going around is not because those groups believe that she's actually broken the law, but she says conservative groups have now taken to spamming us by filing bogus ethics complaints so that Fox News can report on alleged untrue scandals. And indeed, Fox News reported on this. Do you worry at all, as someone who you're an activist and you do a lot of your work online, the idea that sort of hijacking the news cycle for something, like whether this ends up to have anything behind it, the people who initially spread it and are concerned about it are never going to know. They're not going to pay attention to it. So what do you think about the implications of this sort of action being taken?
I think that's a really interesting point, right? So we have these baseless charges. NBC News said there's no evidence for what they're claiming. It's just another instance in this long line of ridiculous accusations and attacks against Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez. So you have this operation, this well-funded, like clearly like deliberate and targeted operation to smear her with every chance they get. But the dynamic you point out is how those things trickle up the right-wing media infrastructure. And if you look at how these things spread, in some instances from 4chan that end up on Breitbart or InfoWars, but then get aggregated by sites like the Daily Caller, who do a little bit less, have convinced enough people in the right-wing media that they're reputable enough to cite, pretty soon it's on Fox News. You have this stream of misinformation going from the darkest corners of the internet all the way up to the cable network that the president watches religiously, and it's alarming. But moreover than that, you've got millions of people relying on this for their main source of information, if not their only source of information. So between that and the disastrous misinformation effects we see in social media, like it's so easy to smear someone. And when you have a motive, and it's this congresswoman who's young and inspiring and capturing like the hearts and minds of millions, that's an easy target for them. Why wouldn't they just use this infrastructure they've been enriching for 3 decades to continue their attacks on her this way?
So I want to go just a little bit broader, but on the same concept, because we're about to enter into, we're already sort of in the beginning stages of this primary process. And so you do, as I said, a lot of your activism online. You will help to spread videos that are important and newsworthy. And you also respond to misinformation on sites like Twitter. So what can we do to try to make this situation better when there's so much information being spread, much of it either intentionally false or of dubious origin? What can we do to help to make the online dialogue during this election as productive as possible?
Well, that's a good question. I think the first thing we could do is take a breath. Like when you see something that might elicit an immediate, strong, visceral reaction, take a step back, take a breath, and assess it. Is this real? I think the one instance that we saw things get really out of hand was with the Covington kids and Fox News, another instance of them using this sort of media narrative to completely reshape how people understood that news story. So it's okay to take a breath. It's okay to wait a second before you tweet or post about it and join the pile on. There's nothing worse than being ill-informed and engaging in political matters. So just validate, look up a second source, see who else has reported it, and don't believe everything you read.
Yeah, and I would like to add too, one of the things I'm trying to figure out how to, in the context of the show, help to do this, but I mean, I remember, like we all have, we're invested in politics, we're passionate about politics. In any election, we're probably gonna have one person that we prefer and others who are big challenges then we would like to see go down. So I would just caution our audience, if you see something that is just perfect, an attack against the person running against your preferred candidate, if it seems too good to be true, maybe it is, and maybe look into it, and maybe every crazy conspiracy theory that feels so good to retweet in the moment isn't actually true, even if we feel like the person who's spreading it should be trustworthy. So that would be my advice. But thankfully, you are very reliable on Twitter, so I'm not too worried about that coming from you.
Thanks, John.
Thank you, as always, for joining us. Always good to get your take on politics, Jordan. Looks like our connection might have broken down just a little bit. Well, thankfully, we got through all the content we wanted to actually get through with him. Now, we're going to take a break. We come back, the most serious matter of the week after this. So this weekend, I decided to shave my facial hair, and it's been pretty much agreed since then that that was a horrible decision and never should have been allowed to happen. Because I then went on to do my job and make videos, and we put them on the internet, and people on the internet had opinions, as they do. And it was not ambiguous as to where people came down on the facial hair. So I want to read some of the best insults of how I looked with this. I'm mainly doing this so the Daily Caller will talk about me this weekend. Anyway, but I also just want to say, I do this every year once. It's like Punxsutawney Phil. I shave and then I look at the mirror and then like, nope, 6 more years of facial hair.
I just wanted to say, before you get into the comments, just how many people around the office, because I, until very recently, produced this show. Now I produce the main show. I just think people should know that. I want you to hear it from me first. But the thing is, most laughing is wrong. People came up to me to say, like, can you somehow communicate to John without hurting his feelings that he should never shave his face?
And it turned out, no, you could not.
Not possible.
You could not. You did communicate, but not in a way that didn't hurt my feelings.
Softball him in there?
Okay, so let's see some of the comments. I'm gonna read this one, and I want you to guess who it is that was going and getting these. So it says, oh no, John, what did you do to your face? Edit, Brooke always wears a good shirt. Turns out it was Sophie. No, it was Brooke. So here was one. By the way, there were hundreds and hundreds of these. There were many of this exact sort of this next one. John without his beard kind of looks like Ted Cruz.
Don't understand.
And I think I'm done in this career. Oh, you had to have him ready to go. Why that picture?
Do it. Now you're up to the side. That's not the face he's making. I get it. I see it.
I did not. I don't look like.
I mean.
No, I don't think.
We're getting a lot. That is screen cap worthy. And if you could please screen cap and hashtag John Cruz.
Okay, I gotta read some more.
Those of you at the podcast,
by the way,
you're missing out.
By the way, all in good fun, but those of you who said I look like Ted Cruz, I hate you and you're blocked. Okay, next. The F happened to John's face. He used to be my hero until his beard fell off. It didn't fall off. That would make me an innocent, a victim. I was the perpetrator of this stupid act. Mariana Moore says, but John, why shave though? All caps. I think that was Donald Trump. Dirk Child said this, and you have, like, this is how it was sold to me. It's just a beard. It's just a beard. It's just a beard. As if to, like, as if the arms were clutched around the knees and they were shaking back and forth. Let's see. Tim Stark said, you need a beard, buddy. That's just advice. That's just good advice. Okay. Dark Riku says, who is this beardless heathen who stole John Roll's hosting position? So they're not worried about the beard. They're worried that I'm missing. Okay, so it's now it's a reportable thing. And let's see. N. Silva said, John is like me. Looks 10 years younger with some hair on the face. Somebody tell him he looks way too straight now. Suit, shaved face. It's not why I come here. On second thought, maybe it isn't the lack of hair. It's just the suit. God damn it, what the hell is he doing in that thing? So,
it was the 1-2 punch, John.
There's so much there.
It was the 1-2 punch of the first day you had no facial hair, and the second day you were wearing a sweater.
I had a good reason for that. Nobody cares.
No one cares about the reason.
Nobody cares. But yes, the combination of the two made me look like a weirdo. I grant you that. But I'm going to wear the sweater again.
And you would just cut your hair. So it was for everyone at home. I understand John doesn't look that weird. It's just that so much weird stuff happened to him.
So can I just say what I have learned from this experience? I think I sort of mentioned it on like Tuesday's show after I started reading the comments. First of all, that I am on a tightrope of passably looking. And if I take one step to the side, it's done. It is done. But more importantly.
No offense, with a beard, you look amazing.
I don't look amazing, but thank you. Now, more importantly, what have I learned? And I want to reveal this on International Women's Day. I think I said this to a few people on staff. I believe that what I experienced is a tiny little sample of what it must be like on an everyday basis.
To be
a woman in this exact same position, where everything that you wear or don't wear, every piece of makeup you put on or don't put on, when you change your hair color, all of it is being critiqued intensely. I've experienced that for less than 1 week ever. And like I think about Anna, like every single day,
like,
that's what
it's about.
I get
what you're doing, but it also like reeks of like, you'll never actually understand it. And no matter how much you qualify, it gives me a sample.
Yeah.
All right.
I said sample. Hey, it's International Women's Day, buddy. Okay, try to be understanding like I'm trying
to be. Take it from us, two guys.
Thank
you. Have a great Women's Day.
Exactly. Who better to, no, anyway. Okay, thank you as always for coming on.
Thank you.
We'll see you next Friday. Thank you for watching. We'll see you next Monday.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.